On last
I like to have you.
through the gate because they got caught realizing I'm not aggressive. I think that's probably the part.
Janet, can you hear me? Well, we are going to go ahead and get started. I always hate to break up good conversation, but Daryl, if you'll come up and lead us in our prayer, and Larry Rickard, will you lead us in our pledge, please?
Well, each of you, please join me by praying in your way while I lead in mine. Our Heavenly Father, we pause to acknowledge you and we thank thee for the many blessings, for another beautiful fall day, for a wonderful community, Lord, in this club, and the freedom to speak and worship as we please. We ask that you bless this meeting, anoint our speaker today, to guide and direct. We'll give you praise in Jesus' name. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Y'all might have to help me a little bit today. I just now caught Ron Estes here. He's our not only our current treasurer, our new treasurer. And Senator Dick Kelsey's with us over here. Carl Costner's with us from Cheney. Now, how many did I miss?
Pretty well.
Judge Brown.
Where did you go?
There he is. Bruce Brown.
One of my favorite people.
Benny Bowman.
Benny Bowman's a newly elected state house member. All I can say is I am glad I suited up. Most of you by now know that I didn't make it, but it was close. You can't put out that much effort, knock on that many doors, talk to that many people, and not spread a message. Those folks, a lot of them, I just didn't spread the message to enough of them, I guess. And but they were very interested in local issues, state issues, and, of course, federal issues. That the wins that we had were unbelievable. And I have to tell you about one of my favorite ones. This is going to get me in a lot of trouble, folks, but I am so excited about losing this guy, a guy named Brumby. If you don't know who he is, he's the one that kept us from having a lot of economic development out west. He's part of our problem in the state in terms of regulatory certainty. With Rod Brumby, there was no such thing as regulatory certainty. He was, the law was according to him. And I was just thrilled that Parkinson decided to give him the axe. And anyway, enough of that. There's going to be a lot of changes. And I'm sure John will be making some connections with a lot of the new policies, right? Our newly elected folks. Hey, Ken, you wanted to come up and say something real quick. Come on up, Ken. Ken Sabosky, Dr. Ken Sabosky from Wichita State.
Make sure to make it here today because Mel Kahn's here, right? But anyhow, I was just telling John, I think sometimes, you know, we take ourselves really rather too seriously and so on, and the late Mel Flickman, he liked to inject humor, you know, about politics and so on. So I thought I'd mention here, you know, I hear that, and I think Kenny Estes had a letter in the newspaper, you know, it's time for the Republicans to kind of get over their losses. Some of them got losses and some of them won and so on, and I thought that was a very good letter, and I told him so. And, you know, and I hear there's warning in certain camps about losses and so on and so forth within the party. But, you know, we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously. And I recall the late Morris Udall, maybe Mel does too, some of the others of you. the late Morris Udall, a United States House member from Arizona, brother Stuart, you know, who was Secretary of the Interior for John Kennedy. Anyhow, so he decided to run for president in 1976. Jimmy Carter got in the race and others. And House members usually aren't very successful. When the election was over, this may be the way a lot of the losers feel, he says, "The voters have spoken, the bastards."
Well, I always get a kick out of Linda Tyler's, just to throw in an extra one. You can't sit stupid, but you can vote it out. So, anyway, we have an extremely interesting special guest today. I'm not going to introduce him, but I have to say this. He bought ice cream from me at the Baskin-Robbins ice cream store that I had when I was 25 years old. So, Mel's been with us a day or two. And I consider him a really good friend, and I appreciate him coming. But I'm going to let John officially introduce him. So, John, come on up and introduce our very special guest today.
Thank you, John. A brief announcement. Next Monday, we're going to Americans for Prosperity is going to have a seminar down at the Alfred Branch Library on South Meridian entitled "I City." It's an exercise, and it's dealing with private property rights. And we're going to try to show what the impact of taxes and regulations and the government incentives that get passed around have on economics. There are some flyers back here if you're interested in that. Next week, we've got Skip Hilday. He's the president and publisher of the Wichita Eagle, is going to be at Pachyderm. He's going to talk about the Eagle's transformation in the digital age. November 19th, we've got M.S. Mitch Mitchell. He's going to talk about the big ditch 60 years later. In the first week in December, Sedgwick County Sheriff Robert Henshaw is going to present us an overview of the county jail. And anyone who has time between 2 and 3 o'clock, the sheriff's going to take anyone who likes for a tour of the jail. And he's promised to give everyone a free get-out-of-jail card. My pleasure to introduce our special guest today. Mel Kahn has been a professor of political science at Wichita State University since 1970. Teaching awards include the Carnegie Foundation selection as Kansas Professor of the Year and the Regents Award for Excellence in Teaching. His published books include The Winning Ticket, Daily, The Machine, and Illinois Politics and the Politics of Labor. He has also presented papers at several national conferences. Kahn taught at the 1996 GOP National Convention Intern Program and was a delegate and platform committee member of two Democratic National Conventions. His other work nationally has included a presentation at the U.S. Court of Appeals Second Circuit Annual Conference. Locally, and at the Pachyderm Club, I have witnessed Mel's excellent portrayals of Alexander Hamilton and Plato, where he comes in with his laurel, and it's a lot of fun. In addition to all of his honors and accolades, Mel asked me to tell you that he flunked the first grade. I'm going to let Mel explain that to us today. Please join me in giving Professor Mel Kahn a warm Pachyderm Club.
Podium, since I don't like, you know, barriers between me and human beings. And somebody asked me how I felt when I was coming in here today, and quite frankly, quite ambivalent. As a Democrat, feel pretty low, not as low as President Obama, but the other guy. On the other hand, as a political scientist, and I'm sure Tim would share this, since accountability is so important to democracy, I was very pleased as a political scientist to see the activation of people who disagreed with the policies that were going on and not only voicing their opinions, but taking action. I think this is the essence of democracy. And the fact of the matter is, to be successful, our republic does require accountability. And for that reason, I believe that when we have attacks, holding people and policies accountable. It helps our processes and profits our nation. And I believe that criticism should pertain to not only policies, but also candidates in terms of their personal characteristics that might affect the way in which they have governed. In terms of things that happened 30 or 40 years ago, I don't think that accomplishes anything. But if a person shows, for example, that he's going to spend more time chasing kids and others than devoting time to the job, and my likelihood to end up spending the last 2 years defending himself rather than doing people's business, I think that's something that should be criticized in advance. And so while I do not favor outright distortions as such, I do approve of evidence-based attacks. And I believe that tough competitive attacks and responses benefit our republic. Let me go back in history and give you some examples. Is this coming across too loud? I think now, is it coming a little loud? All right, let's go back in history. Patriots like Tom Paine wrote negative pamphlets in which they were documenting in very dramatic form the abuses of the British rulers over the colonies. And this inspired a lot of ferment so that we were willing to look at the idea of having a revolution to throw off our yoke. And then our courageous founders came up with the idea of the Declaration of Independence, in which there was a documentation of one negative attack after another toward the British government. And that put the cap on it in terms of setting the standard for having a revolution, which was a great risk then, because, as they said, they pledged their lives and their sacred honor and knew that if they were not successful, they would be executed. We owe them a great debt. And what happened is after we had the Constitution and there were conventions and there were negative attacks back and forth, although sometimes of a personal nature, 37 different proposals for how we should select a president, we finally drafted a document. Not everybody agreed with the British political leader Gladstone. That was the finest document ever drafted. Alexander Hamilton referred to it as a worthless piece of fabric. George Washington and James Madison were disappointed that it didn't go far enough in terms of curbing the then obstacles of the states. We often think now in terms of too much intrusion on the states. But anyway, there was good give and take in terms of negative attacks back and forth. But after we agreed upon this compromise document, that's what it was, a bundle of compromises, the anti-federalists set about pointing out that there was very little protection of individual liberty in the Constitution. And as a result of their concerted negative attacks, the founders were forced to adopt a Bill of Rights, which provided some real protections. So what I'm trying to show is that historically, negative attacks have been a very important part of the American form of government as such. I think the concept can be summarized very well by John Stuart Mill, the famous philosopher, who said that attacks and criticisms make a real contribution. In other words, if the attack has validity to it, and it brings about a feeling on the part of the populace that things can be much better than what turns out to be a flawed type of policy, then we benefit. Because what we've really done is we're exchanging something closer to the truth for the error that we held sacrosanct before. In other words, we should not just rule by authority. Any kind of policy ought to be able to withstand the nature of sharp criticism. On the other hand, if it turns out that the defenders of the policies are able to refute these attacks on them, then it provides us even more confidence in terms of upholding our prior beliefs as such. So it operates with a net plus here. And I'm a strong believer in the idea that debate should be uninhibited, it should be robust, and it should even include vehement, caustic, and unpleasant attacks to make your point. In other words, politics is not a game of tiddlywinks here. And I believe that people ought to bring all things that they can to the encounter, short of outright falsehood as such. Let's take the area of political campaigns. One of the things I resent, I hope there is some media here, but we have a situation now, as the parties have become weaker, that somehow the media feels that it should instruct us in terms of how we should make our choices, who is fit to rule, what policy is acceptable and what isn't. And I believe that if you actually look at the evidence, you'll find that the media doesn't really do its job in terms of candidates. They spend a lot of time on the horse race aspect, who's ahead, who's gaining, what do the polls say, rather than getting into the substance of the real policies. And I think that's a net loss. And I used to get a kick when my former student, Judge Eric Yost, used to say that when he was a young man in the legislature running for re-election, the thing he dreaded most was the endorsement of the Wichita Eagle. All right. Another fascinating thing that I found is that Professor John Geer of Vanderbilt University did a study of the last 20 years of presidential campaigns. And what he found confirmed something that he had suspected. And it was this, that there are more lies and distortions presented in positive ads where candidates blow themselves up, invent all kinds of things, whether it's a Republican, otherwise good congressman, according to my son-in-law and daughter who are in his district, like Kurt, who invent being in Vietnam, and to be bipartisan about it, a Democrat, Blumenthal in Connecticut, did the same thing. And so you get a lot of this in campaigns, of people inventing aspects that attend to try to convey the idea that they are actually greater than what their record would indicate. Let's look at some of the controversial negative attacks in recent times. Willie Horton ad. A lot of people, you know, condemn this attack. Well, the fact of the matter is, Michael Dukakis, who had an image then, according to the media, of being the most competent governor in Massachusetts, did have a weekend furlough program designed with the idea of helping these prisoners get rehabilitated back into society. And what happened? He went on a rampage while he was out, actually, you know, beat a husband and raped his wife. And what happened was that organizations sympathetic toward President Bush, who had been 17 points behind after the two conventions, actually featured Willie Horton. And the question is, did this actually occur? It did. And so I say this is a legitimate type of attack. Also, Barry Goldwater, my favorite senator, not that I ever voted for him, but he was good enough. I used his book in class to let the students know that there's another side from what my democratic progressive orientation was at that time. It's not quite as progressive these days. But anyway, I sent a letter to Barry Goldwater in which I asked him if he would have an amplified telephone dialogue with my students. And about a week later, I received a frank envelope, and inside was my original letter, not a letter from him. And on the top of it, magic marker, he wrote in purple, "Hell yes!" exclamation mark, all my administrative A. And Barry Goldwater went back and forth with my students. And it was a very enlightening session. And I'm sure my students learned a lot more that day than they did from any of the many lectures that I had delivered in the past. Also, the reality was that in 1952, how many people remember who was the vice president on the Republican ticket in 1952?
Richard
Nixon. Eisenhower is running a campaign as clean as a hound's tooth. Well, we wouldn't regard him very much now, but it turned out that Senator Nixon then had a fund contributed to him by conservative factors, and it amounted to $22,000, and the Democrats and the media made a lot of it. And anyway, Nixon received a call from former governor, well, he was still governor then, Dewey, who was the moment of the 1948 election, telling him that, you know, Ike wanted him off the ticket. Now, Nixon realized then if he got off the ticket, that would be pretty much the end of his political ambitions. And so he asked the Republican National Committee to let him go on TV and explain, you know, his side of the story and how he was using the money. And they agreed to do that. Well, I was watching at the time. I was an intern in the federal prison in Washington, D.C., receiving room, board, and laundry while going to law school. It was excellent food. Our chef had been a top chef at the Spadler Hotel. He had a bad habit of writing checks that, you know, but anyway, I was watching with the other prisoners in there, and when yelled out, that crook belongs in here with the rest of us and so forth. But Nixon wanted an answer because he was getting tremendous public response. And Ike took a couple of days, and no answer was forthcoming. Finally, Nixon called up the general, not president yet, and said, you know, and I will clean this up, so sanitize it, so to speak. He used a term the equivalent of, in more crude terms, General, this is politics, and in politics, you've got a fish or cut bait. Well, Eisenhower resented the idea of a 38-year-old kid, referred to him, telling him, a general, what he should do and what he should do. But the sentiment was so overwhelming for keeping Nixon on the ticket, Ike kept him on the ticket. But Ike never did cotton to him. Never took him up to Gettysburg, to Fort David, just kept him at arm's length. Used him to attend funerals and so forth and so on. At the same time, Nixon's a very bright guy, probably the best informed on foreign policy of any president we've had in the 20th century. I still recall hearing him speak the year before he died for about 45 minutes without a single note at the Marriott Hotel, and it was just fascinating to hear him, far superior to what any of the so-called experts had to say. Really new foreign policy here. But anyway, there was a news conference held, and in the news conference, a reporter asked President Eisenhower, in that respect, tell me, what important decision has Richard Nixon played any kind of role in? And I scratched his bald head, and he said, well, I really can't think of any, but if you give me a week or so, I might come up with one. Well, the Kennedy people seized on that, and they spent a lot of their budget on showing that a part of the press conference with Eisenhower. That was a negative attack. I think it was very valid when you have the President of the United States, and the Vice President works for it, saying he hasn't been as active in, you know, foreign policy as he claims to be. Although Nixon, you know, had definitely let his views be known prior to that, and it's shown that he was very well informed. Let's take the other side, a more recent example. Steve Six, during the campaign, had a negative ad on Eric Schmidt. And it was, you know, like quite a biting ad that Eric Schmidt had voted, you know, in favor of increasing the ability to pay the loan industry to receive up to 400%, and then do part of that is, as I understand it, if you aren't able to pay, then you have your car foreclosed and your money is surrendered, and that's a pretty horrible thing. But then what happened is Eric Schmidt came back and pointed out that Steve Six had also accepted money from the payday loan industry. Well, there's nothing worse than a hypocrite in politics, and I think that was quite decisive here. So both men were using negative ads, but one was using it as a counterattack, both of them evidently based on factual evidence. And I think it told the public something that we wouldn't have known had we just said, oh, you should be good boys and just, you know, have positive type ads. Another thing that comes to mind.
President Obama is showing his naivete and inexperience because of spending a few years in the Illinois legislature, skipping controversial votes and playing poker with the boys and getting along, and then being in the Senate for less than a year, not really learning about how the Senate operates or much about national government. Is urged by people to run for president because they were fearful Hillary would be a loser. And so he's elected president. And in his naivete, instead of, you know, saying we need a stimulus, and you know, this is debatable, just like TARP is debatable back and forth, and it's up to the people to decide, you know, whether they work or if so, how little or how much. Obama then goes and goes beyond that and makes a very foolish statement. This stimulus will bring the unemployment rate down to 8%. I think it is very valid. It served the public very well to show that here is a man who doesn't have enough smarts to say, despite the supposedly high IQ and Harvard degree, that you would have a situation where he would have been better off not mentioning what his goal was, and if it happened, fine. If it didn't happen, and you know, say, well, we're inching up there, we're working on it, we're in a deep hole, and so forth and so on. So the essence of my remarks is this. Negative attacks, by their nature, attacks are negative, serve a very useful purpose in establishing accountability. I think that the Democrats will be justified now that the Republicans, you know, could have control of one of the chambers. If they don't contribute to solving our problems, just like the Republicans have been justified, I believe, in making their attacks. So I say, as long as there are evidence-based, it serves our republic extremely well to have people accountable in government. And that's the essence of my remarks. Ready?
Professor, we're such a divided country anymore. These elections on the national, you know, the senators and whatnot, they're coming out 52-48, and really, no one won. I mean, there's no mandate there, and it appears that's going to go on for quite a while. And what are your comments?
Well, a lot of times, so-called mandates aren't. Now, President Reagan, for example, when he won his election, it was really, you might recall, a rejection of Carter. A lot of people thought that, you know, Reagan would be, you know, trigger happy and so forth and so on. But he sold the idea of it being a mandate. And so a lot depends upon, you know, the ability of the person in office. I think Ike was rightfully criticized about the overruns on the V1 bomber as such. And the way he handled it, oh, I thought that they were talking about a vitamin or something like that. So, he was very clever in terms of how he was able to handle his criticisms. But the fact is, we've had divided government before. And we've had grown-ups like Bob Dole, for example, who started off as a flamethrower and later became a very responsible leader. And we even had an example of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, who were at each other's throats over policies at times, nevertheless being able to be civil toward one another, having drinks together later on, and working out some compromises. And I think it's perfectly possible. I believe that we need to, you know, get the right kind of people in government who are willing to engage in a good old-fashioned, good give and take. And so I think that's going to tell the tale here. And I think there are many things that both sides can do in terms of reaching agreement. I think most of us here agree that, you know, at a time of economic difficulty, we ought to try to not raise additional taxes as such. Now, where should the limits be? It might be that you have to work out a compromise and that it's not everybody over $250,000, everybody over $3 million or whatever it might be, because these things just have to be hashed out. What's interesting, though, I heard Senator McConnell yesterday, and he was asked a question in terms of foreign policy, and he pointed out out that he and the Republicans really had not much of a quarrel with President Obama, but he thought he provided a continuity and stability there. And it's rather interesting because he really came into office having no experience there, but evidently he was able to listen to people, whether it turns out to be correct or how far you should go in Afghanistan. Is it money down a rat hole? Or are you giving away too much when you announce a withdrawal date? You know, these are debatable. But it was interesting here that McConnell showed what I would say was a reasonable type of approach in terms of we're not going after him on that. And I think there are things on foreign policy. But, you know, many of the people do accept the idea that politics ends at the water's edge. And we haven't always followed that, but I think that it often works out well. Yes?
Thanks for coming and speaking to us today. I'm curious if you can tell us or maybe describe what you view as one of the worst non-factual based attacks that you can remember.
Wow.
It may be the most effective that people believed in, even if it was non-factually based.
Alexander.
I think that John Adams and Jefferson really went after one another with non-factual attacks. For example, one of the charges against Jefferson was that he was going to burn all the Bibles. And actually, one of Jefferson's supporters was afraid that it would even, you know, refer to backers of Jefferson. He would, you know, show no favoritism on that. Because he was, you know, a godless type of person. He could be called all kinds of names. And so this one individual came over and gave his Bible to a Federalist friend who he thought would be safe there because Jefferson wouldn't think that the Federalist, you know, being so amoral, would have Bibles there. So there's... well, one of the attacks that backfired, I think, that was a valid attack, was in terms of Grover Cleveland fathered a child out of wedlock. And as a young man, he and a friend had both been seeing this young woman. And anyway, when the charge came out, it created quite a sensation. And his Democratic advisors, Cleveland was a conservative Democrat, told him the best thing to do would be deny it. And he said he had checked the calendar, and he probably was the father, and that he had, you know, continue to provide support for this woman and this child. And the Republicans, you know, had a little slogan that went, I won't sing it for you, but, Ma, Ma, where's my pa? He's going to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. And what happened, though, it turned out that James G. Blaine had been on the take from the railroad industries and had succeeded in getting a lot of land delivered over to the railroads for expansion and also utilization for other profit-making aspects, and received kickbacks in the way of being able to purchase that land at much less than its actual price. And so Cleveland was able to counterattack with the line that I have been corrupted my private life, I am ashamed of that, and I just, you know, cannot deny that. My opponent, on the other hand, has been, you know, above board, the epitome of a perfect husband in his private life. But in his public life, he has been very corruptible. And so I think the logical thing is return my opponent to private life, for which he is eminently well suited. In public life, where I am on. So, yes.
I would like your opinion, Professor, and you were one of my favorites at WSU, I have to say, but I would like your opinion on independent expenditures. For instance, you brought up Hoyt Brown, who only ran his commercial showing where they worked space one time. The media then did him a favor. He didn't have any money. He had to borrow money to run it the first time. The media did him a favor and ran it over and over again. Also, Hoyt Brown is very connected to Citizens United, which does an awful lot of independent expenditures to this day, and had the U.S. Supreme Court lawsuit on the corporate expenditures. So anyway, my question is about independent expenditures and the secretiveness, and I think the constitutionally protected secretiveness of people to be able to run ads in a political climate without identifying the source.
Okay, I halfway agree with you. I believe in independent expenditures. I do concur with the idea that this is a form of expression guaranteed by the First Amendment. I do believe that, in terms of my personal biases, that people ought to have an idea to know where the money is coming from. So I do believe in disclosure. Yeah.
I wonder if you'd comment. You're more of an expert on it. Incumbent versus challenger, or where you have two non-incumbents. And would you want to comment on our senatorial race here in the Republican Party primaries this past summer, spring? In terms of attack ads, negativism, and so on. In other words, is there a difference if you have two non-incumbents running against each other, or if you have an incumbent and a challenger?
Well, I know Ronald Reagan, it was a very pragmatic thing, had an 11th commandment about, you know, Republicans not attacking one another. But, you know, both of these men had had successful careers in the House, and I believe that they both ran attack ads. I believe that Moran somehow, while his voting record was very similar, conveyed the idea that he was, you know, a sort of a moderate type of person as such. And I think both men campaigning very hard. And I would say, whether it's against the opposition or in your own party, as long as now this might not hold in a really competitive two-party state, where one person can, you know, ruin the chances for the other person in the general election and such. So it has to be a matter of the particular constituency involved here. But I know Todd DeHart did not go out and campaign for Mrs. Johnson, who I thought was quite interesting. I heard her at a Democratic luncheon, and she was saying that if she got elected, she would be the only PhD in the Senate. And I told Ted that both of us had a big laugh here, because I'm not sure that having a PhD in the Senate is necessarily the answer. although there have been some good ones, like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you might recall, who was a very progressive Democrat, nevertheless, who Nixon had in his cabinet. And so I would say anything should go as long as it's based on evidence.
I'd like to hear your comments about the first grade problems.
Well, I'm very immature. Teacher, I don't think they had retirement in those days. She seemed to be about 90 years old. And she told my mom in my presence that in all her years of teaching, I was by far the stupidest pupil she'd ever had. And she guaranteed that I would never learn to read or write. My mom always maintained she was half correct. Any of you students would back this up, that I never had learned to write.
Well, thank you, Professor Kahn. This question is not about campaigns, but other, you know, goings-on in public policy. If a person wants to be critical, let's say of something going on down at City Hall, and a citizen goes to speak against a policy, must that citizen have an alternative, or is it okay just to say, this is a bad policy, let's just don't do it just because it's bad? Because we get this sometimes, that someone will say, well, what is your idea? And this lack of a better or alternative idea, is that valid criticism from the other side?
I don't think it's valid criticism. I don't think that a citizen who's not in any policy-making role has an obligation to come up with a solution, as long as that person, you know, can point out any flaws that exist. I think one of the unfortunate things that occurred in this past campaign was she was running against a former student of mine who showed guts when he was wounded as a freshman to tangle with Pat Lehman and the labor leader. But I thought Gwen Wellsheimer showed a lot of fortitude when she was willing to question, you know, expenditures for downtown redevelopment, whether or not that will ultimately end up helping Wichita or not. But I think her position was, if it's so great, let them invest their own money and make the profit and take a risk like any other entrepreneur does. And the ego really did a job on her, I think. And I think one of the mistakes she made is she confided in me before the election that she had Tea Party support, but she didn't want, you know, her liberal friends to know about it. And I think that was a mistake on her part. I think there are a lot of people who really treasure, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, somebody, I mean, we're all taxpayers, who will stand up and object to, you know, big spending for big projects. Toby?
Yeah, I'm still puzzled whether this is good or bad, negative campaigning. Go back to Goldwater. The Democrat spin during that election was that if you vote for Goldwater, you'll end up in a war in Vietnam. Well, I voted for Goldwater, and sure as hell, we ended up in a war in Vietnam.
My first question is to you, Professor. Have you read the whole health care bill?
Of course not.
It matters most to Congress.
That's exactly right.
Okay, terrorist plot, thieves plot, murderers plot. The journalists and the Democrats, after this election, the next day, I saw it on the news and they stated that the Republicans were plotting to re-shield Obamacare. And it's amazing words how much power they have. And to bring the two parties together to use that word is just amazing to me. I'm not an educated man. It's my first year voting. I've never voted in my life. I'm 39 years old, and I do thank Jesus, but John Paul or John Todd helped me be who I am today. But I was just asking you if you're familiar with page 1101, and they put it so far in the middle of this health care bill. If anyone's interested in it, please look at that. And I believe that's why Mrs. Pelosi put it as far as she did, and we're going to close that. But the question mainly was about the health care bill. If you've read it all, it's amazing that it was passed, and the political science, some scientists hasn't got to read it yet.
I think both parties have been guilty in the past of slipping things in that are unknown. I was very proud of Ken Sabosky when the group of Wichita Eagle was praising our congressman in terms of, you know, bringing home the bacon to the 4th District, pointing out that the problem was that we were inconsistent. We appreciated, you know, what a congressman could do for us, but we weren't, you know, for what they were doing in their districts, which, you know, added to the voter deficit and such. And we're having sufficient time for, you know, bills to be read, none of this midnight stuff. One of the things, to try to be fair about it, is on the pharmaceutical bill. We're a country that prides ourselves on free enterprise, and yet, unlike the Veterans Administration, which has done this for years, the pharmaceutical bill that was passed for seniors has a provision that says you cannot take competitive bidding. I think this is very un-American. It makes the cost of medicine much higher than if we had competition here. So I think both parties have been guilty of, you know, slipping things into bills when people don't have time to read them. And I'm from rural business.
Yes, Professor Kahn. Maybe a little appeal about the health care bill. Two examples recently of government passing laws and exempting themselves from it, or the health care bill, or Congress exempting themselves. Smoking bans in the state, where the state exempted their state-owned casino gaming floors. You go back to the 60s, and you had OSHA, equal employment opportunity, civil rights, all these things that Congress exempted themselves from. What is your take on that? Because it makes me see red.
No, I mean, obviously, take care of themselves. For example, let's say a change that I'm not aware of. Members of the executive branch are prohibited from going out and doing any kind of lobbying for 2 years. But I think with the Congress, it's only 1 year. And so Billy Towson, who was able to shepherd this provision through the pharmaceutical bill, that, you know, just helps drug companies get millions of dollars as a result of not having competitive bidding, resigned from Congress and took, I think, a $2 million a year lobbyist job. And Democrats do this too. So it's something I don't approve of. And I believe that there ought to be attack ads upon this kind of thing, regardless of who does it.
Why do you think people would put up with it? Back in the 60s, I couldn't fathom it. As a young man, why would people that
well, unlike the kind of people who are assembled here today, I believe the average American puts
politics about number 259 on their order of priorities. I like to twit my students by saying, does anybody know anyone who's more interested in whether they're going to be able to pull a good drunk on the weekend or have a hot date than they are in terms of, you know, what the policies of this country are going to be? And I get a knowing smile from them. They do know people like that. Yes.
Yes, I have a question. The way that this Obamacare bill, as we like to call it, was introduced into the House, made it through the vote, made it to the president's desk, and yet those that were supposed to review it, which were representatives, didn't have, was it 48 or 24 hours to review this humongous pile? Brings the question to my mind, was proper procedure in the House, to the best of your understanding, because I don't know, was it properly followed? And if not, does that make that null and void as a law that's been passed through both houses?
I believe that since this has become a way of life for many years, I doubt if the court would do it on that grounds. Now, they might do it on other grounds. For example, my son, who constantly reminds me how thankful he is that when he ran as a 19-year-old for the state legislature and as a Democrat and got beat, how fortunate he is to now be a businessman. The only thing is he complains about, you know, paying many times more taxes than my salary, and he feels that the government ought to subsidize him, though, because he's creating jobs, because he expects to expand to about 200 frozen yogurt stores. And this is just, you know, a part of where you stand. And I doubt that they would find it unconstitutional on those grounds. There are a lot of things that the Supreme Court in general likes to avoid making definitive decisions unless it's absolutely necessary. There are members of the Supreme Court, though, who act like lawmakers at times, both Democrats and Republicans, and this has been part of our tradition.
So if I understand your answer correctly,
I'm suggesting
that there may have been the procedure had not been followed, but what you're saying is that, practically speaking, it may not be expedient
right to
try to get a repeal on that account.
Yeah. There's another factor, too. I think there are going to be other questions raised about the bill, like the requirement that you have to provide insurance, you know, for people. And it's going to be quite a burden on business as such.
Thank you very much.
Sure. For my... Anyone who has a question wants to? Mark?
Yes, thank you, Mel.
Well, I formed a victims of mine from the first
Let me repeat Paul Rogel and say that you were one of my favorite teachers, if not my favorite political science teacher as well. My question goes back to John Adams. You had mentioned John Adams and the notorious negative race with Thomas Jefferson. Are you familiar with the book that David McCall wrote called John Adams?
Yes.
Are you using that in class and so on?
I have used it in my presidency class. I do like to rotate the outside reading books now.
Okay.
I
just want to let you know, if you haven't read that book, it is one of the best. I wrote a letter to the editor of the Wichita Eagle. They didn't print it, recommending that people read that book. And only after I wrote the letter that I realized that it was on the New York Times bestseller list for like 48 weeks, and that he won a Pulitzer Prize for the book. So I would recommend everybody in here to go to the public library, get the audio tapes, or to get that book. It's just called John Adams by David McCall. It's just excellent. And he's got a lot more detail on that particular race and what happened.
Yeah, and it also, in the process, gives another take on Thomas Jefferson, who we Democrats tend to hold up as, you know, our icon. And in fact, if any of you want to have fun, it's a $10 paperback book called Jefferson and Civil Liberties, The Darker Side, by a man named Leonard Levi. And in it, he talks about the fact that when Jefferson was the majority leader in the Virginia House of Burgesses, he got through, they had trouble apprehending what the term was, marauder, by the name of Josiah Phillips and his band, who went around robbing and sometimes killing people. And so they were so frustrated that they could never catch him. They actually passed a law saying they had 30 days within which to hand themselves in, and failing that, any able-bodied Virginian could shoot on sight. Now, a lot of people didn't even know who was in his band of marauders, but nevertheless, Jefferson cut that bill through. He also used he did like Hume, a realist, who was on the conservative side, and so he used a book in his college he established at the University of Virginia, written by a man named Baxter, and the theme of the book was what Hume should have written. And so for those who believe in academic freedom, the free flow of ideas, Jefferson, despite his eloquent statements that he wrote, was not, you know, the prince of open-mindedness that he's often portrayed. Yes?
I'm curious, from a perspective of a Democrat,
yeah.
I'm curious, you used the word naivete to describe Obama.
Yeah.
How do you think he will react for the next 2 years? How do you think he's going to respond to a Republican-controlled House and a Senate that is likely to be, at least the Democrats in the Senate, are likely to be fairly skittish to resist a Republican-controlled House? How do you think Obama's going to respond?
I believe that he's going to tone down in terms of what he advocates, which many of his pet projects can be passed even when he had the numbers, you know, that was supposedly filibuster-proof, because not everybody agrees with his part with his philosophy. But he's also going to have a very difficult time, because while he may or may not be a socialist, as Toby likes to point out to me, he is receiving a lot of criticism from the left, nothing far left enough. And also there are conservative Democrats, many embittered ones who, you know, went the whole Obama program, who are ex-members of Congress today because of that. And the fact is, most Americans are not overly on the right or on the left. We tend to be a centrist country. At this point, I think we're more centrist right. Other times in our past, we were somewhat centrist left. But I think he's very anxious to try to work out some sort of a deal where he can reduce the unemployment figure. I think if he fails to do that, he's a dead duck. In fact, I dare say that if Hillary Clinton were to resign and challenge him today, if there were a primary and caucus system, I think she would beat him. And so, on the other hand, I do think that he's capable of learning on the job. George Bush started out very naively. He had the benefit of the politics of 9/11. He played that very well. And later on, there are areas where he didn't succeed. On the other hand, to Bush's credit, whether you agree with it or not, he was influenced by the singer Bono to unleash a lot of money for treating AIDS in Africa, which can also have an impact on us as the thing, you know, crosses continents and spreads. So I do think that people are capable of learning on the job. Bill Clinton had even lower ratings, you know, during the midterm of his election, of his first term, and what he did was, there goes the parade, I've got to get in front. I really think that a lot of the credit in terms of balancing the budget ought to go to Newt Gingrich. But we can't give presidents credit for what occurs, whether they had an influential hand in it or not, as well as discredit. But I do think that he's made a mistake in terms of, you know, being upset with Wall Street, which incidentally funded him very well. It wasn't just small donations. And I believe if he's smart, he's going to get some people in there from the real world. And I just don't know what he's going to do. I think he's not going to be advocating an excessive leftist agenda, though. I think that, you know, he says that he would be content with one term as having left a legacy for health care and so forth and so on. But most presidents do crave a second term, even though they usually do not fare too well in their second term, whoever they are.
Professor Malcolm. This is a manual on how he can join the Republicans.
Thank you,
Mel. I've never heard Mel speak that it wasn't extremely interesting. So, I didn't get a chance to talk to Ron Estes before the meeting, but would you like to introduce Linda? Come on up here. And, be careful now. Be careful. We have a precinct committee meeting on the 11th next week, and there's going to be a
operation.
All right. Well, I'll try to say a lot real quick. As you know, I was elected the state treasurer, and thank you for all your help. Part of that process, the replacement for me as state, as county treasurer basically goes into the precinct, the Republican precinct committee men and committee women. I officially resigned Wednesday, sent a letter to the governor saying that I was resigning effective January 9th, and with the intention of being that next week when the reorganization meeting occurs, they could also have the vote for county treasurer for my replacement at the same time, instead of trying to schedule another meeting in December. And there a couple of people, well, over time, people have talked about who might be running. But as of right now, the only person who I know of that's running is my chief deputy, Linda Kazire. Linda's worked with me ever since I was the county treasurer elected and been in office for 5 years. So she kind of knows a little bit about what I've been doing. Yes, Mark.
Just the point. By the way, I think Linda is extremely well qualified and an excellent employee, and I wish her luck if she wins. James Bowman, who used to be the Sedgwick County, have you talked to him? Okay, he was interested. I don't know.
James Bowman is one of those guys that had originally said he might be interested, but he, as of yesterday, told me that he was not going to.
Okay,
so, yeah. So. But anyway, if you're interested, the meeting's next week. If you're not a precinct committee member, you can come watch the process. Or if you are a precinct person, participate in it next Thursday. Thank you.
Dan Heflin, you had a quick announcement.
Yeah. Next Friday in Topeka, they're presenting the findings of the joint committee on tax reform. Is that correct?
Tax
assessment. They're going to have the findings, and we are planning with the Fair Tax KC group to have a march on the Capitol with Dave Kelsey's support, and then we're going to have a rally afterwards at the Art Center in Topeka, and Dave Kelsey will also be speaking at that to the group, as well as we have a whole slate of speakers. We would really appreciate anybody who can attend to come up. We're going to plan on meeting at the Art Center at 9 o'clock and then make that march to the Capitol and make our presence known about our desire for a more simplified tax system. Thank you.
Great.
We didn't get Phil Hermanson introduced, he came in later.
Oh, our Phil Hermanson, he gets to do it again.
I just wanted to thank Greg and Mark and some other people that really helped me out, but I'm not your casual state representative. I go into the doctor right after this to get my knee reworked, so that's why I'm in shorts. So I just wanted to explain.
Again, on the 11th is the Republican Party in Sedgwick County reorganization meeting. Last year, I was so mad about the way they handled it that I swore that would never happen again. And it looks like it's about to happen again. So those of you who are precinct committee people, if you'd stick around just a little bit afterward, if you have the time, I'd like to say a few things to you.
Good plan.
This situation is such that it's become a process of exclusion from the party, and I don't like it. Doesn't mean that I'm going to have any say in it, because they're going to have the gavel, and I'm just concerned that we bring all kinds of Republicans in to the process, and not just those that think they own the process. So, please, if you're interested, we've got some things to talk about. Those of you who are elected precinct people, thanks all of you for coming today. Who's our speaker next week?
The editor of the Wichita Eagle.
Oh boy, that ought to be it. John likes to get us stirred up, so I think that will. Anyway, thanks for coming, and we'll see y'all next week.
Thank you.